From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
That's really where my drive and focus is. But they do reasonably well. We generally do a book signing once a month. People either I'll schedule one or somebody will have me at a group, and they do well. There's a lot of interest. These first two books have been about history, and so people kind of want to know that you know what you're talking about, right? They see this younger guy, at least relatively speaking, walk into the room talking about Black Bottom and Paradise Valley. Like, he wasn't around. So they kind of want to hear you for 5 or 10 minutes. I did a book signing, and a couple of seniors, women, they sat in the first row. They got there early. We talked a little small talk. And I think I got the sense that they were trying to check me out. Say, does this guy know what he's talking about? And then I might buy the book if he knows what he's talking about. Right. So, and I guess I knew what I was talking about. One of them pointed out later when we talked, I grew up in Black Bottom. I wanted to wait and see if you knew, knew X, Y, and Z and all this. I studied this stuff pretty intently. And then I wasn't around for it.
Ken Coleman, author of Million Dollars Worth of Nerve, 21 People Who Helped Power Black Bottom, Paradise Valley, and Detroit's Lower East Side. Coleman is the popular author of On This Day in Detroit and Soul on Air. On This Day in Detroit shares facts about events in Detroit's African-American history on the same day that those events happened. In compiling the information for his first book, On This Day, African-American Life in Detroit, Coleman research kept pointing him towards Paradise Valley and Black Bottom of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. Then the political and cultural heart of Detroit's African-American community. Coleman decided to focus his next book on the rich life of these neighborhoods. Million Dollars Worth of Nerve tells the story of Paradise Valley, Black Bottom, and the Lower East Side communities, how they came to be, the forces that caused their demise, systematic racism, discrimination, freeway construction, and suburban sprawl. The story is told, in part, through personality profiles of 21 Detroit residents, all of whom are African American. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Million Dollars Worth of Nerve with Ken Coleman, In Black America.
These are two areas that had largely African-American population. Both of them were located just outside of downtown Detroit. Paradise Valley was the entertainment and cultural community, very small community, but dozens of businesses, lots of which were owned by African-Americans. To the south of Paradise Valley was Black Bottom. And Black Bottom was the residential community where probably 3 out of every 4 Black Detroiters in the 30s, 40s, and 50s where they lived. Interestingly enough, many of your listeners might think that it was called Black Bottom because black people lived there. That's not so. The moniker for that community came many decades before African Americans came to Detroit en masse. It had the very rich topsoil, fertile topsoil in Black Bottom.
Black Bottom was a predominantly African-American neighborhood in Detroit, Michigan, that was demolished and replaced with Lafayette Park in the 1960s. The Black Bottom and Paradise Valley area of the city's east side became known for a significant contribution to music, including blues, big band, and jazz, from the 1930s to the 1950s. The district reached its social, cultural, and political peak in the 1920s. African Americans owned 350 businesses in Detroit at the time, most of them Black Bottom. It was located on Detroit's Near East Side, bound by Gratiot Avenue, Brush Street, Vernon Highway, and the Grand Trunk Railroad tracks. The entire district was destroyed in the early 1960s. One had asked a question over the years, was it urban renewal or Negro removal? Born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, Ken Coleman attended Detroit Public Schools and later worked for DPS as a community relations officer. He has been active in Detroit media as a news anchor and an editor of the Michigan Chronicle and the Michigan Front Page. Also, he served as the City of Detroit Charter Revision Commissioner from 2009 to 2012. It took Coleman 16 months to research and write Million Dollars Worth of Nerve. He says it was time well spent, because the book presents a segment of the Motor City's history that's rarely read about these days. Recently, In Black America spoke with Coleman regarding his work.
It was and has been great, John. I like to describe myself as a post-rebellion, Detroit Rebellion baby. I was born in December of 1967, and of course you know, and many of your listeners
right.
know, that there was an urban rebellion earlier that summer in July of 1967. And it was a touch-tone moment for many people who lived in metropolitan Detroit and across the country. Lots of people don't know. People might remember the rebellion itself, but during the early days of it, it was about a 6 or 7 day set of events, John, but during the early days of the rebellion is when President Lyndon Baines Johnson commissioned, called together the Kerner Commission,
right.
which ultimately produced the landmark report on race relations in America. It was the rebellion in Detroit that was the trigger to that President Johnson pulled that group together. Detroit is like a lot of urban cities. It is what is one of the I guess few of what we like to call in the 60s and 70s or 70s and 80s chocolate cities, majority black cities, and certainly by the 70s and 80s had leadership downtown in City Hall that reflected the population of the city. We elected in 1973 Coleman Young as mayor, and he was one of not the first African American mayor of a large city, but certainly was part of a generation that included mayors in Los Angeles and in Cleveland and in other places around the country.
Now, Mr. Coleman, what sparked that initial interest in writing about this section of Detroit?
Well, it's fascinating, John. The first book I wrote was called On This Day, African-American
right.
Life in Detroit, and it's sort of a day calendar book where I take each day of the year and list several important events that happened on that particular day in the history of Detroit, events that were carried out by African-Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing On This Day, African-American Life in Detroit, I kept stumbling on information coming out of the communities known as Paradise Valley and Black Bottom. And for your listeners, these are two areas that had largely African-American populations. Both of them were located just outside of downtown Detroit. Paradise Valley was the entertainment and cultural community, very small community, but dozens of businesses, lots of which were owned by African Americans. To the south of Paradise Valley was Black Bottom. And Black Bottom was the residential community where probably 3 out of every 4 black Detroiters in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, where they lived. Interestingly enough, many of your listeners might think that it was called Black Bottom because black people lived there. That's not so. The moniker for that community came many decades before African Americans came to Detroit en masse. It had a very rich topsoil, fertile topsoil
mm-hmm.
in Black Bottom. And in the 1800s, lots of European farmers, immigrants, farmers lived in that community. And so you had German farmers, Polish farmers, Italian farmers, and they had farmland in that community, and so the topsoil was black and fertile, and the name stuck as Black Bottom. But those two communities I kept reading about through working on the first book, the great business leaders that came out of that community, the great politicians. Many people will be familiar with Charles Diggs
right.
Jr., one of the first African Americans to be elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. Charlie Diggs grew up in that community. He was born in that community because his dad was a leading business owner in Detroit in the 20s and 30s. And so fascinating history, and it really sparked interest in trying to learn as much as I could and then ultimately writing Million Dollars Worth of Nerve about those communities.
Mr. Coleman, we're going to try to give a visual picture of the area in which you're speaking of for those who may have been familiar with Detroit or who have visited Detroit. We have the Detroit River, which is the south side of the city?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so having the Detroit River as the south side, give us the parameter if you're looking
sure.
at Woodward Avenue, I guess, being to
yeah.
the...
West of these two communities,
okay.
just a hair to the west. You've raised a great point. The Detroit River is the southern boundary of the city of Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a great trivia question in this part of the country. And it, as you know, it goes a little something like this. Most people don't realize that we're actually north of the Canadian border,
exactly.
At least in the section of North America where we are. Canada is to the south of us, actually. And what separates Windsor, Ontario in Canada,
mm-hmm.
from Detroit is the Detroit River. So the river is the southern boundary. Black Bottom is on the riverfront in the 20s and 30s and 40s, unlike other cities, maybe like Chicago or New York or Manhattan, what lined our riverfront in Detroit in the 20s, 30s, and 40s was industry. Because we made things in Detroit. We made cars and we helped the industrial age. So we had a lot of working gritty factories along our riverfront.
Right.
And so that's what lined the Detroit River. But the neighborhood just to the immediate north of that was Black Bottom. And the way it looked, it was a very aging community in terms of its physical structure.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the buildings by the 1930s and 40s, many of the homes and buildings had been built 50 or 100 years before.
Right.
And they were built, lots of them, with wood. Not some brick, but not a lot of brick. And
mm-hmm.
so these were, as we described them in the South a lot, as sort of shotgun homes, very narrow plots of land. Oftentimes by the 30s, 40s, and 50s when African-Americans moved into Black Bottom, you would have maybe an apartment rooming unit that was made for maybe two or three families. They would be sectioned off and divided up in maybe a half dozen pieces, two rooms to a unit, and African-American families lived there. And so as blacks came up from the South to look for those Henry Ford assembly line jobs paying $5 a day, they moved into Black Bottom. And this is very interesting. Consider this. In 1910, the city's black population was 5,000 people. 20 years later, in 1930, it had skyrocketed to 120,000 people. And these people, because of being new to the city, many of them, because of spatial racism and not being able to live in other parts of the city, lots of these people lived in the same community, a very population-dense community called Black Bottom. Paradise Valley comes together because, they like everybody else, they want to be entertained. They want to go to a restaurant to have dinner. They may want to go to a bar or a nightclub to have a Friday night, to hear great jazz or R&B. And so Paradise Valley, immediately to the north of Black Bottom, becomes the entertainment center. And there are very, very colorful people who were the business owners and the stewards of that community. And I write about them in Million Dollars Worth of Nerve.
Mr. Comas, tell us about Hastings Street.
Yes. Hastings Street, we mentioned Woodward very briefly. Woodward
right.
is the major thoroughfare, probably the preeminent thoroughfare in Detroit. It goes from the foot of the Detroit River out into the northern suburbs.
Right.
But in those times, probably the second most busiest street in terms
mm-hmm.
of commerce and activity was Hastings Street, which was located about four blocks to the east.
Right.
Now, Hastings Street is significant to Black Bottom and Paradise Valley because it is perhaps the busiest thoroughfare in those two communities. It is actually one of the streets that sort of ties the two communities together.
Mm-hmm.
Hastings Street has been described by some as Detroit's Bourbon Street.
Right.
What Bourbon Street was in New Orleans. What some of the major boulevards in Harlem were to Manhattan. So you had everything on Hastings Street. You had businesses, you had churches, you had illicit activity,
mm-hmm.
illegal activity. Numbers running was a very popular activity in the 30s, 40s, and 50s in Paradise Valley and Black Bottom. That was there. But it was the major thoroughfare that some 20 or 30 years later was sacrificed for an urban renewal project, and a freeway was built along where Hastings Street lay in the late 1950s and early 1960s, literally destroyed in a large way, both the residential community, Black Bottom, and the entertainment cultural center, Paradise Valley.
Yeah, no, that's right. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Kenneth Coleman, author of Million Dollar Worth of Nerve, 21 People Who Helped to Power Black Bottom, Paradise Valley, and Detroit's Lower East Side. Mr. Coleman, how did these Southern, I'm going to call them immigrants, happen to migrate to this section of Detroit?
Yeah, it's an interesting story, John. Well, like in a lot of cities, Chicago, to be sure, our neighbor to the west, and to some extent New York, when Black Americans from the South heard about the industrial prowess that northern cities like Detroit was carrying out, Henry Ford putting together, having the gumption to create the assembly line to build cars in 1914, and hearing that you could earn $5 a day by working in the Ford Rouge plant. Well, that reverberated down south, 1,000 miles into Alabama, into Georgia, into Mississippi. And so African Americans came here in droves, even before the First World War, but certainly by the 20s and 30s, came en masse. When they got here by train, by hitchhike, by car, they found that in a lot of ways, spatial racism, residential racism, mm-hmm. racism in housing and in real estate was just as oppressive as where they came from in the South. And so there was only really maybe two communities where African Americans could act, once they got here, could actually settle. And one of them was Black Bottom, the community that we described just north of the Detroit River. Another community really was in the early days, was really sort of reserved for African Americans who may have been here for a couple of generations and may have been able to amass some savings, been here and understood the climate. And that was a community called what we call the Old West Side, probably about 6 or 7 miles to the west of downtown Detroit and the river. But that was almost reserved, John, for people who were ready to buy a home. They may have started a family. They may have been here 10, 12, or 15 years and working at the Ford Rouge plant. And living on the west side, which was a lot closer to the Ford Rouge plant, was a viable community to live in. I know you know a whole lot about Conic Gardens.
Yes.
And Conic Gardens was probably the third community. But Conic Gardens, as you know, they were definitely homeowners. I mean, they were people that worked in the post office. They were teachers.
Doctors, lawyers.
Had elected, absolutely. Mm-hmm. They were people who actually built their own homes because mm-hmm. in that community, there was a special deed designation that allowed blacks to be able to build a home in Detroit. That was unprecedented and unheard of in so many communities. But those were the three sort of major residential communities in Detroit in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Black Bottom, the Old West Side, and on the Northeast Side, Conic Gardens.
I was particularly enamored with the 21 individuals, and I'm quite sure that was difficult for you to just settle on those 21. But what led you to make the decision that these individuals needed to be profiled in the book?
It's a great question, and I get it all the time. You're right. There are any number of people that could have been profiled that were significant in some way, form, or fashion. But a lot of what went into the decision on the 21 people that I chose, I wanted some gender balance. I wanted to make sure that there were women. And it was, clearly the 20s, 30s, and 40s was, American society was a very sexist society, not only in the black community, but in America in general.
Right.
And so African-American women weren't given opportunities to do a lot of things, but there were certainly some great women in Detroit that did. So wanted to make sure we had women. Wanted to make sure we had a good mix of people, bar owners, pastors, business people, mm-hmm. Community activists, if you will. And so we came up with Sonny Wilson, who's one of the great entrepreneurs, owned the Forest Club bar on Hastings Street in Forest. It was described in the 1920s and 30s, just before Sonny Wilson was able to buy the club, the Forest Club was described as an indoor amusement park, John. If you can imagine what that is. And square footage-wise was almost as big as Madison Square Garden on Manhattan Island. Sonny Wilson was a pivotal figure in Detroit in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and he came here after graduating from Allen University in South Carolina. He earned a bachelor's degree in the 1920s, and he drove a Cadillac up here, a 1927 Cadillac, to Detroit for his first trip. But Sonny was a great entertainment entrepreneur. But there were people from the clergy community that were very important. Probably nobody was more important than the Reverend Robert Bradby, Sr. Right. Reverend Bradby was pastor of the first African-American church in Michigan, Second Baptist Church, and lots of people know that Second Baptist Church was a stop on the Underground Railroad in the slavery days, where African-Americans from the South who could manage to make the trek up north toward freedom on their way to Canada would stop here in Detroit before getting across the river. Second Baptist Church was a major hub for that activity, and Reverend Bradby was very important. I've talked a couple times about Ford Motor Company and Henry Ford. Well, it has been written, and certainly the history has been handed down, that in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, when Reverend Bradby called Ford Motor Company and suggested that they hire, you know, Johnny Smith, who just got here from Birmingham, Alabama, and is a good man, a good Christian church man. When Reverend Bradby made that call to Ford Motor Company, Johnny Smith got that job at the foundry plant. That's how powerful Reverend Robert Bradby Sr. was, a black man in times where racism was very prevalent. And so we've got an entertainment owner, bar club owner like Sonny Wilson. We've got a pastor like Robert Bradby. But we also have Fannie B. Peck.
Exactly.
Fannie B. Peck. And Fannie B. Peck is significant because for a couple different reasons. Her husband, William Peck, was the pastor of Bethel AME Church beginning in 1928. But Fannie stood as a leader in her own right. She holds the distinction of being the first woman, to be able to secure a charter to operate a credit union in the United States. Imagine that. A black woman in the 1930s in the throes of the Great Depression, let alone tremendous societal and institutional racism. That's how important Fannie Peck was. And so, again, we wanted gender balance. We wanted vocational balance. We wanted people from all walks of life, but people who happened to be African-American and who lived, worked, and played in Black Bottom or Paradise Valley.
When you did the research, Mr. Coleman, what was it about these individuals? Some of them were college educated, but when they came to Detroit, they weren't satisfied just with the status quo.
Right. Well, and that's where the book's title, Million Dollars Worth of Nerve, comes from. I'll tell a quick story. Louis Martin, the first editor of the Michigan Chronicle newspaper, the state's largest black newspaper.
Came from the Defender, didn't he?
Yep, came out of the Chicago Defender tree.
Okay.
John Sinstack, the owner and founder of the Chicago Defender, sends Louis Martin to Detroit for the purposes of starting a Detroit version of the Defender that would ultimately stand on its own as a newspaper unto itself,
right.
But be part of the chain. Louis Martin is sent here in April of 1936 with, and he is quoted as saying, $135 in his pocket and $1 million worth of nerve. What I took Louis Martin to be saying is that to organize black people in Detroit in the 1930s and 40s took more. It was more than a notion, and it took people with extraordinary fortitude and strength. And that's, I think, what you see time after time in these stories that these 21 people carried out. They all have one thing in common. Some of them went to college, as you mentioned, John. Some of them didn't. Some of them were pastors, but some of them were what we call in today's terms, they were ballers.
Exactly.
I mean, they hung out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they all did something extraordinary. They all took on the status quo. Oftentimes, they spoke truth to power, even when it hurt them personally or their family. But they all did it to improve their lives as individuals, but improve the lives of the community in which they lived. So one of the women that I write about in the book, Rosa Gregg, leads an organization called the National, or at that time, the Detroit Association of Colored Women's Organizations. They are a loosely formed umbrella group of dozens of black women's groups, their social groups. They were called, lots of these groups at the time were called study groups. And they would meet, and maybe sometimes around societal issues, economic advancement, or just playing bridge. But Rosa Gregg had an idea. She grew up in she lived on the Lower East Side of Detroit.
Right.
And there was a huge home about 500 feet from her that she had designs on. She made up her mind. She wanted this home to be the headquarters for the organization, the Women's Clubs organization. The only problem is the home was located on Ferry Street in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And during that time, there were certain homes that had deed restrictions that would not allow an African American or perhaps someone Jewish to own the home,
right,
even if they had the money.
Exactly.
Well, Rosa Gregg was able to pull her resources, find out at some stage of the buying effort that they could not inhabitate the home,
mm-hmm,
because of a deed restriction. Well, $1 million worth of nerve. Rosa Gregg, she and her organization petitioned the city fathers and mothers, many at that time, they're basically all white men, their fathers, petitioned city government downtown to change the address of the Ferry Street to,
right,
Brush Street. And by doing that, was able to get around the deed restriction.
Exactly.
Well, that took tremendous gumption, tremendous nerve, $1 million worth of nerve. And so, again, these people, time after time, John, making a way out of no way, $1 million worth of nerve, challenging the status quo, challenging downtown, challenging racism, to move themselves ahead and African Americans ahead. That's the beauty, I think, in this and the research that I've been able to do and been able to work on with others, is that there's so many of these stories. And at a time when many of us in Black America are facing challenges of some sort, it's empowering, inspiring, and motivating to look at these stories of what these people did 30 and 40, 50, 60
mm-hmm.
years ago, when, you know, they didn't have, you know, some of these organizations that we have now just weren't around at the time, or they were in their infancy stages.
Ken Coleman, author of $1 million Worth of Nerve, 21 People Who Helped Power Black Bottom, Paradise Valley, and Detroit's Lower East Side. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.